Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at Community Progressive Radio or CindySheehanSoapbox.com. We have a very interesting show today. It's a long show. It's about an hour and 45 minutes, so you might want to listen to it in segments or listen to the entire show if you want. It's a conference call that I recorded with about 50 people and our guest, Dr. Margaret Flowers, who is a leading advocate and expert on single-payer health care and on Obamacare. So listen up to the show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this national conference call about the so-called Affordable Care Act. We're going to try to dispel the myths about it, and we're going to try and discuss how we can all go forward to demand and achieve Medicare for all. Our guest tonight is pediatrician and healthcare advocate and my friend, Dr. Margaret Flowers. I'm going to let Margaret tell you a little about herself and give her a chance to make a statement about the subject. Then we'll take your questions that you have submitted to me in advance. And I'll give the ground rules for the questions. Please, if you're just joining the call, push star 6, please. And there's questions that were admitted to me in advance, and I'll give the ground rules for the questions before I turn it over to Margaret. First of all, in case any of you haven't figured it out, my name is Cindy Sheehan. I'm a peace and social justice activist, and I'm sure you all know who I am and about my story. But I'm also the host of a radio talk show called Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. And this call is being recorded for that program, and it's going to be first broadcast this Sunday. And if you have an objection to being recorded, then you can just listen to the call and not publicly ask a question, or you can send me via email the question to ask Margaret. If you submitted a question for Margaret in advance, I will call on you to unmute your phone by pressing star 6, and I'm going to call on you by name to unmute your phone. And then you'll be pressing star 6 and ask Margaret your question. Please stay unmuted until after she answers, just in case you need a clarification. So this can be a sort of a dialogue. We can't have 200 people talking at once, but we want to hear, and I know Margaret wants to hear many voices too. And after the question is finished, I'll remind you to remute your phone. And I'm going to call on you by your first name and state, if I know it. If you want to give your last name and town where you live, that's up to you. If you think of a question or a statement during the call, you can email it to me at revolutionalovestory@gmail.com. That's revolutionalovestory@gmail.com. And I'm sorry, due to the numbers of people we have on this call, we just can't allow any interruptions. So if you feel a burning need to have your voice heard, you'll have to email me so I can call on you first. Margaret, we'd like to thank you for taking time to participate in this conference call, and there's been much excitement and already some great discussion on the Facebook page. So I'm going to welcome Margaret to come on the call. She can introduce herself and make her statement. Margaret, please come in, and welcome to this conference call, and many thanks to you.
Great. Thank you, Cindy, for organizing this and for all that you do, and thank you to everyone who's joined the call tonight. This is a really important time, and I'm glad to see that people are interested in continuing to talk about and strategize about ways to get to our goal of having health care for every person in the United States. I wanted to start out with just to bring up a few topics, and then definitely want to get into questions. But just to start out, when the Affordable Care Act, the ACA, was being put together in Congress, and we, you know, saw how the insurance companies and the other industries that profit off of it were putting it together, the provisions that we were the most opposed to were the individual mandate requiring every person to purchase private insurance, and the addition of the taxpayer subsidies to help some people purchase insurance. It's estimated that close to $500 billion will be spent of taxpayer money between 2014 and 2019 on subsidies. And so we had said, well, if you just take those two provisions out, when I say that, I say that who we are, that we were the single-payer movement, that we could support the Affordable Care Act if there was no individual mandate and not using public dollars to go towards private insurance companies, that we would rather use those public dollars to support our public programs. We supported the expansion of Medicaid. We supported attempts to regulate private insurance. We just don't think that any of those measures are adequate. Can you hear me okay?
Margaret.
Yeah,
I can hear you fine, but there's somebody who hasn't muted their phone, so please, if you just joined the call, mute your phone using star 6 because you're interfering with the call. So please, mute your phone if you're not Margaret. If you're not Margaret Flowers, then press star 6. Okay. Somebody is not muting their phone. Margaret, can you hear me?
Okay. I'm
going to unmute everybody, but you're going to have to unmute yourself using star 6, okay?
Okay.
So I'm gonna mute everybody, and right after I do that, you unmute yourself.
Okay.
Okay, Margaret, please unmute yourself and continue.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, much better. Thank you.
Great. That is much better. Okay, so I was saying that when the bill was being put together, the parts that we disagreed with the most were the individual mandate and using taxpayer dollars to subsidize the purchase of private insurance, effectively giving our taxpayer dollars directly to the private insurance companies. Instead, those dollars should be used to support our public programs and to pay for actual health care. We supported the expansion of Medicaid. We supported attempts to regulate the insurance industries. We just know that none of these measures will be sufficient to address the crisis that we have in this country. So I want to skip forward to the Supreme Court decision that happened recently, because this was absolutely, for the people, the worst possible decision that there could be. This is probably not something that you're hearing from Democrats, who are saying that this is a step forward and this is a good thing. We don't agree with that. Basically, just prior to the Supreme Court's decision, when it looked like the individual mandate was going to be found unconstitutional, we started seeing movement from so-called progressive groups that had not been vocal for Medicare for All suddenly coming out and starting to support publicly Medicare for All. We also saw that the Congressional Progressive Caucus was willing to hold a press conference on the day of the Supreme Court decision declaring their support for Medicare for All. Of course, as soon as the decision was made and the law was found to be constitutional, all of that energy towards Medicare for All that we were seeing from those groups disappeared. In addition, the way that they decided on the individual mandate, using it as a tax, sets a bad precedent. It's basically penalizing people for not doing something, in this case, not purchasing private insurance. It's also not very enforceable. That was something the insurance companies opposed, but that means that it leaves the door open for people to just go ahead and not purchase insurance if they find it unaffordable, and they don't have to worry too much about being penalized for that. The IRS would actually have to sue each person individually for not paying the penalty. And then the worst part of it really was what they did with Medicaid. Part of the Affordable Care Act, they anticipated that about 32 million people were going to gain insurance, some sort of coverage, by the time it was fully implemented in 2019, and that about a half of those, or 16 million, would get coverage through an expansion of Medicaid. The Supreme Court decision said that states do not have to expand their Medicaid programs, and there'll be no penalty for them if they don't do that. Already, states are saying, I think about 7 states, including Texas, Wisconsin, are saying that they're not going to expand their Medicaid. I think there are a number of other states that are considering it. And I've seen various estimates that between 8.5 million and 11.5 million people who were going to gain coverage through Medicaid expansion are not going to gain that. So where we are in terms of the Affordable Care Act after the Supreme Court's decision, in terms of the number of people that are anticipated to be uninsured, the initial number when they passed the law was 23 million would still be uninsured in 2019. Shortly, a little while after that, the Congressional Budget Office redid that estimate and said 26 million people would still be uninsured in 2019. Now, with the Medicaid expansion not being enforced, we could see maybe 35 million or more people in 2019 with no coverage at all. So this is what mirrors what we've seen at the state level. Whenever a state passed what they called a comprehensive health legislation and made claims about how many people were going to be covered, they never reach those goals. So we anticipate that there'll still be many tens of millions of people left out in 2019. We're also moving in the direction of more and more underinsured. In the Affordable Care Act, the states are required to set up health insurance exchanges that have four tiers of plans in terms of their coverage: the platinum, gold, silver, and bronze. Now, the subsidies only apply to the silver plans, and the silver plans are expected to cover about 70% of what are considered covered services. The bronze plans are expected to cover 60%. Then, of course, the gold is 80% and the platinum is 90%. But since there are no caps on premiums, we anticipate that people will continue to migrate, as they are doing, towards the lower coverage plans because those are the more affordable plans. And we know that it's estimated about 20 million people will lose their employer-based insurance because it's less expensive for businesses to pay the penalty than it is for them to insure their employees. So those employees who, many of them have fairly decent plans through their employers, the employer plans do tend on the whole to be better than the plans on the individual market, are going to be put into the individual market, into these exchanges. And so we'll continue to see people purchasing these lower benefit plans, which leave them financially vulnerable. Through the copays and deductibles and the uncovered parts, what we end up with is people have insurance, but when they actually need health care, they find that they can't afford to pay for the care, or they get into a situation with a serious accident or illness where, because of the mounting medical bills, they go into bankruptcy and sometimes lose their home. So we're going to continue to see that in Massachusetts, where this same type of plan under Romney has been enforced now for over 5 years. The number of bankruptcies due to medical illness and costs are continuing to rise, so we expect that to continue to rise. Another concern about the Affordable Care Act is that it doesn't do anything to stem the privatization of our health care. In fact, we anticipate that there's going to be even more privatization. You may have heard that WellPoint just recently purchased Amerigroup for $4.9 billion cash, I think it was. Amerigroup is the largest private Medicaid administrator in the country. And this is because WellPoint anticipates that more and more states are going to be putting their Medicaid into these private management managed care organizations. Those MCOs tend to, they have much higher administrative costs, and they also make a profit, so much less of those Medicaid dollars actually go for care. We're also seeing hospital corporations, and their stock actually went up right after the Supreme Court decision. More and more hospital corporations that are taking over public hospitals, basically looting them, leaving them bankrupt for the government to then bail out afterwards. There's nothing to stop that. Also, in the Affordable Care Act, there are no proven cost controls. We've seen different estimates. The Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services estimated that our health care costs as a whole will rise faster because of the Affordable Care Act. That's because of the added bureaucracy and administration that is required by this law through the exchanges, through the IRS, through the need to regulate insurance companies. All of that adds costs, and there are no controls to actually bring our pharmaceutical costs down or our health care service costs down. And lastly, I just want to touch about on the outcomes, our health outcomes. As many of you know, that we pay the most for health care each year per person compared to other nations around the world, but our health comes are fairly poor, with us being ranked about 37th worldwide. I don't think we're going to see a large improvement in our health outcomes. So we see the decision around the Affordable Care Act, and now the fact that so much attention is being turned towards implementing it, and people are saying we just need to wait and see how it works, even though we know it's not going to work, that takes away from the energy for Medicare for All. So we're going to have to work really hard to brainstorm on ways to try to maintain that energy and actually increase it, because we're not going to control our health care costs, cover everybody, bring our health care outcomes up until we get private insurance and for-profit industries out of our health care. So we do still have single-payer bills in Congress, in the House, and in the Senate. They're not really going very far. The number of sponsors are down. We do have a number of states that are trying to pass single-payer at the state level. Vermont passed a bill, which they hope ultimately, if all goes well and they can get the waivers that they need, would become as close to a single-payer system as a state can get. I think that as far as the state work goes, the real value of state work is the grassroots organizing and education about single-payer that comes out of that, and the fact that the state single-payer work does push the state legislation to be better than it otherwise would be. I have real concerns about giving states blanket waivers to kind of do what they want to do, because while some states will try to implement high-quality plans, other states will not. And if we start breaking our Medicare down state by state, putting into state single-payer systems, it's going to hurt the Medicare system that we have right now. So I think the state work is important, but really I think our goal needs to be covering every single person in the nation, and that's going to take national legislation. Another area of energy for the single-payer movement is divestment campaigns, and the Presbyterian Church USA just last week voted to divest their funds out of any private insurance corporations, and there's a movement towards getting other organizations to divest of private insurance. There's a big focus on TIAA TREF, which is a pension plan for many people who are involved in universities. And I think July 17th in New York, there's going to be an action around the TIAA CREF meeting. And if people are interested in that, I can forward that information to Cindy or post it on the Facebook page. So going forward, people keep saying, well, we have to do healthcare reform incrementally, and the ACA is a step forward. ACA is a step backwards. It takes us towards greater privatization of our health care. The two smallest incremental steps that we can take at this point to put us on the right path in the right direction are to create a health care system that's not for profit, meaning that it's about health, and the other is to have the funds to pay for that. And a single payer system gives us the greatest amount of money to pay for actual care, because through a single payer system we significantly reduce the amount of administrative costs. Right now about a third of our healthcare dollar goes towards administration. It's about $400 billion a year under a single payer system. Instead of 33% or so, it would be about 3-5%, leaving more money to actual healthcare. We're going to have to really fight to protect our public insurances, Medicaid and Medicare. As we've seen, President Obama was willing, when the Super Committee was meeting last fall, to make cuts to Medicare. We're going to see, as our economy continues to decline, we're going to see these austerity measures pushed on us, and we're going to have to try to defend our public insurances. We're going to need to continue to document what's going on in this country, with people going bankrupt, people dying of preventable causes, people suffering unnecessarily, health disparities rising. We're going to need to oppose closings of our clinics and hospitals, as we see in lower-income areas. There's been a drive around the country to shut down hospitals in those areas and shut down clinics. We're going to need to continue to fight the disinformation campaign and tell the truth with a nonpartisan lens. This is very hard to do because the partisanship is pretty strong, and the misinformation that's coming from both the Democrats and the Republicans is pretty high. So it's not always popular with our friends and neighbors to tell the truth, but it's important to do. We also need to keep our eyes on some of the real fundamental drivers of our healthcare crisis, which is also the wealth divide. Even if we give people access to healthcare in the United States, we're not going to see a great improvement of our health outcomes until we reduce the wealth divide, because all of these social determinants, things like education, housing, a job with a living wage, our stress levels, these are all related to our health. That's why I'm co-director of a project called It's Our Economy.us that educates about how to democratize the economy, and there's a lot of energy for that happening around the world and also happening in the United States. There's a growing movement for things like public banking and cooperative businesses. And then we really need to build a broad-based movement that takes on corporate power. It's why I was one of the initial organizers of the occupation of Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C., as we saw that as a first step towards building an independent, broad-based, nonviolent movement. All of us who advocate for our issues, whether it's peace, healthcare, education, getting, you know, the financial situation, the environment, we all are coming up against the same obstacles, which is the corporate control of our political process and our media. And if we work together, I think we can be effective in organizing and taking this on. So that's where I want to leave it with my comments, and then I'm happy to take questions, and I really appreciate each of you for being on the call tonight.
Oh, thank you, Margaret. That was a lot of information. I'm gonna go with the last question I just got first, because I think it's very pertinent to what you, all the information you just gave us. Is there somewhere online, or is there a page somewhere that we could access that would have bullet points about the misinformation about Obamacare and concise points about what we really want?
You know, the Physicians for a National Health Program, which is PNHP.org, on the home page down in the bottom right-hand side has an article you can click on about why we opposed the Affordable Care Act, and it goes through and talks about each of those. I also have an article on itsoureconomy.us. It's called Healthcare is About Patients, Not Political Careers. And I went through some of the points on that. I did create, after the Supreme Court decision, and I had a lot of media invitations, afterwards I sat down and just wrote down all of the things that I was saying, because I thought that might be helpful for other people. So I can share that with you as well.
Okay, perfect. We'll get it on. We'll get all that information on the Facebook page for sure. But I have, the first question comes from me, and you kind of already answered it, but there's been a lot of Obama supporters who, you know, would support a single-payer Medicare for All system, but since Obamacare is not that, they're supporting it, saying it's a reform of healthcare. At least he reformed healthcare, they say, and it's a wonderful step in the right direction of single-payer healthcare or Medicare for all. In like 10 years, we're all going to be praising Obama's name when we have, we all have this wonderful healthcare system. And you did answer that a little bit, but I'd like you to be more specific about that.
Sure. This is why I think it's so important not to look at this through a partisan lens. When the Supreme Court was actually doing the hearings on the Affordable Care Act, we were down there in front of the Supreme Court, and the idea of the individual mandate actually came out of the Heritage Foundation, a right-wing think tank, and that was part of Romney's bill, and then it was part of Obama's bill. But when we were down there, we would talk to people from the Heritage Foundation and ask them what they thought about the individual mandate, and they said, no, we're opposed to it. And then the people on the Democrat groups, like Families USA, Healthcare for America Now, were out there saying, you know, support the mandate, this, you know, right-wing idea. So it was really all about politics down there and not about policy at all. So we've really got to get the politics out of it and just look at this. This does not create a healthcare system, does not address the fundamental problems that we have in this country, which are people who are either uninsured or underinsured, does not control our healthcare costs, and it further privatizes our health care. Those are the main things. So uninsured, underinsured, not controlling our health care costs, and further privatizing our health care, all those take us in the wrong direction.
We have a great question that specifically is going to address some of the biggest examples of why the Democrats are supporting this. So I won't ask those, but one last question for me, and then we're going to go to the listeners. But what would you say is the best example or examples of a national health care policy that we could look to try to emulate a model?
Well, in the United States, we actually have three models that are being used. One is a purely socialized system, and that would be our Veterans Health Administration and also our military system, which are owned and operated by the government. We then have Medicare, which traditional Medicare, not the privatized portion, which is the Medicare Advantage, but traditional Medicare is publicly financed, and people are able to choose, you know, where they want to go for their care. That would be publicly financed, independently delivered. And then the third system is our system of private insurances. If we just compared those three systems, we would see that actually the socialized system and the Medicare system function much better than the privatized system. They're more efficient. They have better health outcomes. We see that when people go into Medicare, when they reach 65, the health disparities start to decrease. As everybody's finally able to access care. And groups, you know, people, especially the military and the Veterans Health Administration, unlike private insurance, they have a long-term investment in their population. It's not like private insurers where they're just going to, they know that on average people have private insurance, stay with their particular plan for maybe 3 years. That long-term investment means that they actually want to keep that population healthy as opposed to the private insurers, which are just trying not to pay for care as much as they can. So if we just compared those systems, we would see socialized and the Medicare work the best.
Okay, great. So thank you so much. We're going to go now to the listeners who submitted questions. And the first one was from Joanne in Illinois. So Joanne, you were asking about the health care bills in your state. Can you put, if you're on the call, can you press *6 and unmute yourself and ask Margaret your question? If I don't hear from you in a few seconds, I'll ask Margaret your question for you. Sometimes it takes a little while for the *6 thing to work. Are you there, Joanne? Okay, so I'm going to ask her question for her. Margaret, are you aware in Illinois there's someone named Mary Flowers and her health care bills? If so, what do you think of those as models for others? And you would have to explain them for people who don't know what her bills are if you're aware of them.
You know, I know Mary Flowers. I've met her when I've been in Chicago for Physicians for National Health Program events. I have not read the text of those bills, so I can't comment on the content of them, but I can try to take a look at them, you know, later, and if Joanne wants to email me, the easiest email address is just my name, Margaret, M-A-R-G-A-R-E-T, at pnhp.org.
So is this Mary Flowers, is she also a Medicare for All advocate? Like you are?
She's a state delegate, and she's been the sponsor for their state single payer bill for a number of years. She's a great speaker, very dynamic. I think she gets it pretty well, the importance of single payer, but I just don't know the text of that piece of legislation.
Okay, cool. Joanne, if you're on the call, I hope that answered your question. Okay, so our second comments and questions came from someone, I don't know this person's name, but on Facebook, he or she goes as Vast Left, that's V-A-S-T Left. He or she didn't know if he or she was going to be able to be on the call. So if you're here, Vast Left, will you unmute your phone? Or if not, I'll give the comments. We'll give you a couple seconds. These are actually the specific ones that when people support Obama's health care bill that they talk about. So anyway, I guess Bast isn't on the call, so I'll go ahead. And it says, would everyone who's a single-payer advocate please be vigilant about challenging the continued reference to public option as if it were a meaningful, consistently defined health care reform policy. So right off the bat, this person has a problem with saying public option, that it is a health care policy. Even very astute people lose the narrative about this, not noticing that public option was a well-financed distraction from both real reform and the corrupt process that brought us Obamacare. Margaret, would you like to comment on that part?
Sure, I'd be happy to, because that the creation of the public option was really genius. I mean, so we have, in this country, we already know that we have two decades of polling showing that 60 to 65% of people in the United States support Medicare for All. The majority of physicians support it, and if you look at support by party, it's 80% of Democrats that support this. So how was President Obama and his group of leadership going to get through a corporate health care bill knowing that there was so much support for Medicare for All? They did that by dividing the movement that supports real health reform by creating this public option and saying single-payer is too hard, not politically feasible, but what is politically feasible is this so-called public option, which would be a publicly financed health insurance that people would have the choice of buying into. We knew from a policy standpoint that that creating another publicly financed health insurance was not going to solve our problem. What's happened in the past is that those public plans tend to end up with people who are the sickest as the insurance companies continue to use their maneuvers to cherry pick and only insure people who are relatively healthy, and those public plans then end up failing due to the financial burden of trying to pay for people who need care. And they also just add one more insurance to our big problem, which is the fact that we have way too many insurances that are mean that we have this huge insurance bureaucracy. So it was a failed policy, but it was very effective in dividing the movement that supports health reform. And what's really amazing to me is that in March of 2009, even before the first hearings had started on the health reform process, Max Baucus said in the Center for American Progress that the public option was just a bargaining chip anyway. They never really intended to have that in the final legislation. So anyway, but to be short, the thing that people are going to be hearing now is a Medicare buy-in. This is what groups like Move On and Rebuild the Dream are talking about when they say Medicare for All. They're saying everybody should have the option to buy into Medicare. That's not going to work. It's not going to solve our problem. We call it Medicare for Some, and it's really important to guard against that and keep saying Medicare for All.
Well, and then the public option was many of the legislatures, and I think even Obama said that they wouldn't go for a bill that didn't have a robust public option. But like you said, it didn't even have any public option. Instead, it's a mandate, and a public option turned into a mandate for everybody to have to purchase it.
Yeah, the individual mandate was something they were actually pushing for from the beginning. The insurance companies were insisting. At each of the hearings that I went to, the insurance company representative would always say, we can't do this unless we have this individual mandate so that we can increase our insurance pools, you know, as if, you know, that was really going to be helpful, knowing that we have so many different insurance pools that, you know, just making 1,500 different insurance pools bigger was not going to solve our problem. What was telling to me was the House bill, when it was voted on, did have a public option in it, and there was a lot of pressure on the Senate to put one in their bill. And when it looked like more senators were starting to support putting a public option in the Senate bill, the leadership in the White House started pushing against them and telling them not to include it. So it was really a ruse all the time. But it's not a good policy. It's a failed policy. It's not a solution anyway.
And Bast West had one other question. Please discuss the legitimacy or lack thereof of proponents' biggest claim for Obamacare, such as ending pre-existing condition denials, The claim that insurers are forced to use 85% or thereabouts of premiums for health care payments, and also one that many people tell me is that, well, at least my child can stay on my insurance until he or she is 26 if they're in school. What are the legitimate... Sorry, Margaret, you talk.
Sure. So the legislation tried to regulate insurance companies in a couple ways. One, by saying that they should no longer turn away people due to pre-existing conditions. But insurance companies have other ways of dealing with people that they don't want to insure. One way they do that is by saying that, sure, we'll offer you a policy, but they make it so expensive that people can't afford it. Another way they do it is by restricting their network so that they don't cover services at institutions that take care of people that are fairly sick. Like we see in Massachusetts, one of the big insurers there stopped covering any services at their children's hospital, knowing that that's where children go when they have serious medical conditions. So those are ways that they try to get around those pre-existing condition regulations. Another one was restricting insurance companies so that they had to use a certain percentage of their premiums to actually pay for health care, and it's 85% for some plans and 80% for others if premiums have to go towards health care. So they're saying off the top, they're totally fine with insurance companies keeping 15 to 20% of their premiums. And if you compare that to Medicaid or Medicare, where only about 3 to 5% of their dollars go to administration and nothing goes to profit, the rest is all towards care. It's really a huge giveaway even to give them 80 or 85%, using those levels. But insurance companies are, they've been doing it for a while at the level considered health care and what's not, and they start defining some of their administrative services as actual health care. But insurance companies have been very involved at making sure that in each of the states where they're putting together their exchanges, that the insurance companies have voices in there pushing on the regulations at the state level. And also, it's important to know that regulations, as everybody probably already knows this, are only good if they're being enforced. And so while we may have all of these, great-sounding regulations, if the insurance companies are not abiding by them and they're not being enforced, it's not going to be effective. And this is something that we see not uncommonly, that insurance companies will not cover things that they're supposed to cover, and then they have to get caught at it and have that exposed, and then they'll pay a penalty, and then they may change their ways. But this has been tried before. Insurance companies are just very savvy at getting around so many of these rules. And then the thing about, having more 26-year-olds, kids up until 26, of course, that's a good thing. But in truth, we want everybody to be covered, not just more kids, more people that are 26 and under. And again, those people that are covered up to age 26 are people whose parents have insurance plans and can afford to keep their children on them.
Oh my gosh, I just choked on nothing. I was talking and all of a sudden, I think I'm okay. So thank you. I think that was a good answer, what I could hear when I wasn't choking. Our next question from a listener is from Bowen. Bowen, are you on the call? If you want to unmute yourself with *6 so you can ask your question or make your comment. Everybody's so shy tonight. Bowen, are you there? Okay, I guess I'm going to ask Bowen's question, too. I was hoping we'd have more voices come on. People wouldn't be so shy to talk. Maybe when we get to the questions of the people who just emailed me questions, I want to talk. So here's what Bowen said. Here's my take. Don't know if there's a question in it, but right-wing think plan called socialist when introduced by a liberal president, booed and hissed by Republicans when found constitutional by a liberal ha-ha Supreme Court. So two apparent choices. Number one, join forces to overturn it. So he means people who don't like it from a left-wing and a right-wing perspective to join forces to have it overturned. Or two, treating it as a starting point, embracing and expanding on the socialist label, pushing for a common tax to support it, and thereby gaining support from an increasingly non-affiliated electorate, kind of an end run. I think the mandate is Biden is distasteful enough to stay forefront as a common enemy between the left and the right, I guess. I think the smartest guys in the room have stepped on their tails on this one. There's a principle here shared by most that should be exploited, being forced to buy a defective product by threat of punishment from Big Brother. So I guess Bowen's statement or question is, can we make common ground with the right wing who says that it's socialist? And I also saw somebody post today that it should be overturned by the left, not by the right. So what's your perspective? Because we know that Congress is busy trying to invalidate the bill or whatever. And I heard Boehner or Boehner say today that we have the best healthcare delivery system in the world, so we don't need to mess with it. So what's your comments on that, Margaret?
Actually, I was one of the 50 doctors that signed an amicus brief to the Supreme Court opposing the individual mandate, and that put us in an unusual position of not being on either the right or the left. We certainly didn't oppose the other provisions of the bill, the Medicaid expansion or the attempts to regulate insurance. We just knew those were not going to be effective. I'm not really interested in putting my energy towards bringing down the whole bill. I think that the worst piece of it, the individual mandate, we could certainly organize around that. But the problem with the right-wing opposition is that the solution they have they just don't really have a solution. If anything, they want to move towards further privatization of our healthcare and allowing insurance companies to sell plans across state lines, which is much like what we see with corporate regulations, is that insurance companies are all going to go to the states that have the least insurance regulations and sell their plans out of there, so they're going to be even more defective and skimpier policies. The idea of embracing the socialist tag, the problem is that the Affordable Care Act is just completely the opposite of socialism. I think that Obama in the White House made a huge mistake by being afraid of the term socialism, because as we see now and could have predicted, anything that they did was going to be labeled as socialism. So if they were going to be labeled, they probably should have just gone for it from the beginning. But that was for whatever reason, I think they took the wrong lessons from the 1990s. So I'd be curious to hear what other people think on that.
Okay, me too. So hopefully, like I said, the people who joined us with questions today will want to chime in. I saw an interesting comment on the wall. So this is from Sarah in Oregon. She didn't necessarily want to ask you a question, so I'm just going to read her comment. And it says, for people like myself who have a rare disease, no matter what health care plan program is in place, we are screwed. I have never been denied care due to a pre-existing condition, but due to evidence-based health care payment model. This states if there is not evidence to show the treatment works, we will not pay for the treatment. I recently had to go through an appeal process with Medicaid to get my upcoming brain surgery paid for due to this. As my disorder is rare, there's not enough of us to warrant the healthcare community to do the test to prove the evidence. And the question I have from this comment from the Facebook event page is, would a national single-payer or Medicare for All program change things for people like Sarah?
Hey, so, I mean, that's the actual goal is to create, you know, as I said, the two smallest incremental steps we can take are to create a system that's nonprofit, that's actually about health, and then to use most of our healthcare dollars to pay for actual healthcare services. There's a lot that we need to do to change things to improve our health outcomes. And one model, which, you know, definitely we need to push for, which I think would be more likely, now I'm going to start to get wonky, if we had a healthcare system that was about health, is adopting like what they do in France. France is the best system in the world. They have the best health outcomes. They spend about half what we spend per person, and they cover everybody, even new immigrants to their country. If a physician sees a patient and determines that that patient needs a treatment that is maybe not a standard treatment, or they have an unusual condition, what that physician does is talks to other physicians within the system, explains to them what the plan is, and if the other physicians agree that it's a reasonable approach, then it's covered. They're allowed to try it. So it's people that are experienced in that field getting together, discussing the patient, determining, you know, if what the one physician thinks is a good idea is actually a good idea, and then allowing that. That's the way it actually should be. It shouldn't be administrators who have no medical knowledge, who are just, you know, really out to make a profit anyway and deny care, making the decision. So this is the direction we want to go to, is towards a real rational healthcare type of system.
Okay, great. Then we have a question from Dwight. Dwight is a veteran. I don't know what state he's from, but Dwight, if you're on the call and you'd like to ask Margaret the question you sent, can you press star 6 and come on and talk to me and Margaret?
I sure can, if you can hear me.
Yes,
can
you
hear me? We can hear you, Dwight. Great.
Yay!
I'm a veteran, a disabled vet, and what I was interested in is what, right now I have received treatment from the VA for all my medical, but not my dental. What will happen with the new program, and what would happen to veterans under single payer?
Right, so the bill that we support is one in the House called H.R. 676, and it's pretty easy to read. I think it's less than 40 pages. But it is, the coverage on that is defined, and it's very comprehensive. It includes all pharmaceuticals, medical devices, dental, vision, mental health, substance abuse, long-term care, because if we want to have the most cost-efficient system, it needs to be really comprehensive. The idea is to make the bureaucracy piece of it very simple by having everybody in, so there's no need to figure out eligibility, and by not needing to have supplemental plans, which further complicate things. So under that, the veterans, under a Medicare for All, veterans could choose where they want to go. They could continue to go to the veterans' hospitals, or they could choose to go to other physicians in other hospitals. It would just be all rolled into the same system.
Okay.
Does that answer your... sorry, Dwight. Go ahead.
And what about dental?
Yeah, so dental would be... It would be dental, mental, vision. All of that would be included.
Okay. And the number of the bill?
It's called H.R. 676. And if you go to the Library of Congress website, and you can look it up there, or if you go to, there's a national grassroots group called Healthcare Now. It's healthcare-now. And I'm pretty sure that under resources on that website, you can read the legislation.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Dwight. Please press star 6 again and mute yourself. I had a question. Oh, yeah. What does this bill, Margaret, due to the, you know, the amazing health care insurance that Congress and the people who work in the government get?
Well, the members of Congress have a pretty good deal, but I wouldn't say that the staffers have such a great deal. It's just the staffers choose from private insurance, and some of it is good and some of it is not very good. But one of the beauties of a single-payer system is that everybody is in the same system. That's important, because what we want in this country, or what we're fighting for, is to have a single standard of high-quality care for every single person. So it doesn't matter what your situation is, you're able to have the same standard of care as anybody else. And when everybody's in that same system, it's not like a two-tiered system where some people get more and some people get less. When everybody's in the same system, then everybody wants to defend that system and make it be the best system that it can be. So members of Congress, the 1%, everybody would be in the same system.
Okay, awesome. The next question is coming from Alan in Minnesota. Alan, are you on the call? I know you had quite a thread going on the page today.
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Hi, Alan. Yes, Alan. Thank you.
My question to Dr. Flowers would be, do you support building a movement around a national public health care system in which single payer would be a first step towards a socialized health care system, with perhaps primary health care phased in very rapidly as the foundation upon which this national public health care system can continue to be phased in sooner rather than later?
You know, I do. I definitely, and sometimes question whether we shouldn't be pushing for a national health system first and then, you know, compromising for a Medicare for all. But, you know, I support approaches that are evidence-based. The national health systems work, and we know that a primary care backbone is very important for improving our health outcomes. In this country, we're really backwards in terms of the ratio of primary care doctors to specialists. And we have very few primary care doctors, relatively, and that's hurting our health outcomes. So definitely would support building a National Health Service primary care workforce.
What's preventing PNHP from supporting that position?
You know, I don't know. It's not something that I've brought up with the leadership at PNHP, but it's a member-driven organization primarily. I don't know. I wish I had an answer for you there, but I don't.
Because the other aspect of that question is that the only way the Canadians got their single-payer system is after Thomas Douglas got people in Saskatchewan struggling for a socialized health care system, and single-payer came about as a result of a compromise.
Yeah. I mean, I know that there are physicians in Physicians for National Health program that support a national health service. There's a contingent of physicians that come out of our, you know, public health service core. So, and docs that have been involved with the American Public Health Association. So I know there are people that definitely support that approach.
It's not just VA that's a socialized health care system in this country. You also have the Indian Health Service.
Right.
And this is to me, it's even more important to look at that than it is to look at VA. But the thing is, we have a president in the Congress that severely underfunds both VA and the Indian Health Service. I don't know what makes anybody think that Obama is even going to fund the few good parts of his Obamacare, which I call the health insurance industry and pharmaceutical, you know, privatization.
Profit protection, yeah.
Yeah, and this is a terrible situation we got, because we got to talk about building more than what anything. We got to talk about how we're going to build this movement to force these politicians to do something. I don't see how we're going to do it without establishing another political party similar to what they have in Canada and the Socialist New Democratic Party.
We're not
talk about that, really.
I mean, it's pretty clear. We take kind of the Martin Luther King approach. He didn't ever endorse a candidate. He never allied with a political party. He felt that it was important for him to focus on the issue independent of political parties and to hold whoever is in office accountable. And that's, that was why I got involved in organizing the Occupation of Freedom Plaza, is that I feel the same way, that we need to build an independent movement. We need to be more broad-based. We need to be strategic in our actions, working together to really strategically try to shift the power in this country. I think that at this point, the electoral system is so rigged. We really have a mirage democracy that I don't see an independent candidate winning, although I'm certainly going to vote for an independent candidate. It's really so rigged that anybody who tries to be progressive or honest about the issues is shut out. So we need to work to weaken the, if we've studied, you know, the Gene Sharp of the Albert Einstein Institute, aeinstein.org, and Gene Sharp is one of the world experts in how nonviolent movements shift power. And he talks about the pillars that hold the current power structure up, and you need to work strategically to weaken those pillars. So we see this as a really a long-term movement of right now education and movement building, and then working strategically to protest what's going on. And I think, you know, protest is really important to show that we're aware, that we're watching, and to expose what's going on and to get the truth out, but also building alternative models that we want to see that replace what's currently going on. And I think shifting the economy through creating a more democratized economy is a really important way to weaken corporate power and start to reduce the wealth divide and bring people into a more participatory, democratic process to get to kind of learn what that's like and how it could actually be different and actually would be much better, you know, in a situation like that. So we have a long way to go, but I'm committed. I know Alan's about to answer your question.
Well, it's an answer to my question, not that I agree with it, but I think that we need to struggle on the two fronts, in the streets and on the electoral front. And I don't know how we can do that without, you know, creating a new political party in this country. So,
okay, well, thank you so much. That's a different subject for another call that we agree with.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Alan. So please mute your phone again, star 6. Before we go to the next questioner, there's Sandra from Pittsburgh is on the call, and she says that, Margaret, you're doing an excellent job. And an important correction is the Presbyterian Church's USA's resolution says it was not for divestment from health insurance companies. It was to examine the practices of health insurance companies and report it to the General Assemblies in 2014 and 2016 with consideration of future divestment if necessary.
Oh, thank you for that correction. I thought they had voted to go with them. But, okay, thanks for that, Sandra.
So probably future divestment. So, Catherine, if you're on the phone, I mean, I know you're on the call, but if you'd like to unmute your phone, I know you had several questions for Margaret. So press star 6. Catherine, come to our call.
Hi,
Catherine.
Hi. You kind of have answered so many, but the one that I had, I think, is more of a technical question to explain. How do Medicaid and Medicare work currently, as in regards to the money, the flow of money? I was just curious to know when people talk about that currently. Like, how does the money get from the federal government the states, and what rules they have to follow in the programs? And
sure, I can give you a kind of a general response to that. I'm not an expert on Medicare and Medicaid financing, but in terms of Medicare, Medicare is financed through a payroll tax, the FISA tax, and that's actually separate kind of from our federal budget. So when you hear people saying that, you know, Medicare is breaking our budget, that's not true, because it's like Social Security, it has its own financing. Medicare has the traditional Medicare, which was the original Medicare, which is completely public, where the government pays. But it also, we now have these Medicare Advantage plans that people can buy, which are private insurance plans, and the federal government gives those insurance companies some money, and I think that the patients also pay into that through premiums as well. So it's kind of jumbled, but the money comes from a payroll tax. In terms of Medicaid, those are state financed, and so I guess they're financed probably through state taxes. But again, I'm not an expert on this. I know that Medicaid financing is a huge burden for state budgets, and there are varying degrees of federal financing of the state Medicaid plans. But the states
and
are really
the coverage in Medicaid is terrible usually.
It really varies from state to state. But like Medicare is a national plan that has, you know, a national. Right now, it's what's called a defined benefit plan, where there's certain benefits that have to be covered. What Paul Ryan is trying to do is change it into a defined, like premium, where everybody would just get a certain amount of money, a voucher to purchase private insurance, and so that wouldn't be no longer would there be defined benefits. Medicaid varies from state to state depending on, you know, different states have different coverage eligibility. Some are really poor where, you know, they only cover people who make like 25% of the federal poverty level. Others are more generous. And there's always a balance at the state level of do you cover more people or do you provide more services? And that's a constant struggle.
And getting worse, I assume. The other question was about alternative health care in terms of, you know, both, I guess, what your any position on it so with PNHP or her personally about that being part of the comprehensive coverage that you'd seek.
Yeah, again, what we need to be focused on is what works and what brings the healthiest population and in place, you know, the movements towards more of the integrated health kind of system is happening in the United States. It's much more advanced than other countries. So if you look at France, for example, they're very far along in incorporating alternative treatments into their system because, you know, if there are treatments that are proven to be effective and have good outcomes, and in many cases, they end up being even more cost-effective than Western type of medical practices. So it's about getting a system that's about health and then getting real information about what works and what doesn't work, as opposed to right now we have this, because of the for-profit type of situation, you have all these companies that are pushing their products or their treatments and trying, you know, to make money off of it and not even necessarily proving whether it works or not. So having a public system allows us to focus on what works.
All right, thank you.
Sure. Okay, I just heard a male voice, and everybody that isn't talking needs to have their phone muted. So if you know that you're unmuted, please press, this is going to be a disaster. I think it's okay. Let's just keep going. Judy, you had a few questions for Margaret. Are you there? And would you like to unmute your phone and ask Margaret your questions?
Hi, Cindy, and hi, Dr. Flowers. Thank you very much for explaining the pitfalls of the ACA. Can you hear me just okay?
Yes, you sound great.
Great. My main question is, do you think getting money out of politics might be the first thing that we need to do to move toward a more representative democracy that would pass a thing like H.R. 676?
Now, I do think that getting money out of politics is really important. To get money out of politics is going to also take building a mass movement that, you know, puts pressure to make that change happen. I guess my focus right now is on how do we build this mass movement and how do we strategically shift the power in this country, and that's why I really support creating these alternative structures that work outside of the corporate system, which weaken the system but also build what we want to have to replace that. It's a really complicated question, because just getting money out of politics is not going to be sufficient. If you look at Citizens United, we had problems, you know, before Citizens United, so just getting rid of that's not going to be a solution. But it's certainly, I guess, sorry, I'm giving a really roundabout answer. Yes, that would be helpful. It's going to take a mass movement to get there, and that's what we need to be focused on right now, is building that movement.
The other question I had to do with the environment and why isn't anyone making the connection. You know, our environment has a lot to do with our health, and it seems that as the polluters keep polluting, our health keeps going down. And I would like for you to address that. If there's any way you know of, we measure that. Are we even addressing the costs going up because the environment is being compromised?
And the environment is hugely important. And I mean, there are people who study and look at the health effects. When we were occupying Freedom Plaza, one of our regular actions was something called Occupy the EPA, because the EPA, you know, has the data. They know that the policies that they put forth are responsible for a certain number of deaths of people, for ER visits and you know, medical conditions, but yet they continue to pass these weak regulations, knowing those outcomes, so we're putting some pressure on them. With that, this is where I think it's really got to be a broad-based movement. We've got to see that all of these things are connected. You know, even the campaign against Monsanto is really important, looking at, you know, the genetically modified organisms and genetically engineered foods. If you're not aware, there's a campaign called Millions Against Monsanto that's pushing in California, maybe the first state where they require labeling of the food so people know if there's genetically engineered foods. All these things are important. We've got to be working together.
All these groups that do all these amazing things, it seems like they're all disjointed. It almost feels like we need to find all the common threads and put these groups into contact with one another. It seems like an inefficient method.
Yeah, that was actually when we organized the Occupation of Freedom Plaza, we were very clear that it was being organized by individuals, but we felt the need for it to be broad-based, so we invited organizations to endorse it, but no organization was in charge of it, and it was not created to help build an organization's list. It was just that they were supporting and being a part of this action, and so I do think we need to build these coalitions. I think in a lot of ways I see them happening. People are starting to come together to work on issues. A big one that's happening is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which, if you don't know much about it, this is something we really need to work towards, seeing if we can expose it and stop it. It's a global agreement which will really redefine the terms of globalization in ways that give corporations huge amounts of power, more power than national governments. Their trade agreements will trump national laws. They'll trump environmental laws. So if a corporation has a practice and a country says that practice is harming their environment and asks them to stop it, corporation can sue the country for loss of profits because of that environmental regulation. Serious, not a good situation. But that's another thing that we've been trying to do is bring groups together to talk about solutions. And we just published a report on itsoureconomy.us from a people summit where we did that. And I urge people to read that because it gives a lot of information about what's going on, groups that are working on them, and solutions that are out there.
What was the organization you said that had the broad-based?
It's called, the website is October2011.org, October2011.org. And we had about 160 different organizations that signed on to that. But I also see it happening if, within the Occupy movement, there's a tool called InterOccupy. And what InterOccupy does is it allows, sorry, those are my dogs, it allows people to organize around particular issues, come together from all around the country, and work together in organizing. And so if you go to the InterOccupy, you'll see all these different, groups that are working together on different subjects, and you can join in.
Judy, thank you. We're going to have to move on. We have several more questions, so thank you for your questions. Is there a Richard emailed me a question? Would you like to unmute your phone and ask Margaret your question? I'm sorry, I don't want to say Richard's last name, and he didn't tell me his city or state he lived in, but it's about working with the Green Party, Socialist Party, and other parties to create change. Okay, I'll ask Richard's question. Richard says,
Hello?
Are you there, Richard? Why are you there?
Yes.
There you are. Go ahead.
Yes, it's kind of similar along the lines to what Alan asked, and I know you don't feel like it's going to be successful, but then you talk later about forming a movement and an alternate party. You may be right, this time around hasn't a chance, but gee, I'd like to see, find out what's been done and if anything else could be done to get a variety of third parties to work together, like the Green Party and the Socialist Party and other like-minded groups, to try to join forces somewhat for the purpose of forming a movement.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great idea. I think that, you know, I don't have a lot of hope that in this go-around, the parties are going to, you know, independent parties are going to have a chance to, you know, I'm hoping that they will affect the outcome of the election, that they'll put some pressure on the people that are running. I think that we've got to continue organizing through these next 4 years. We have a real opportunity because the economy is going to continue to go down. More and more people are going to see that the Democrat and Republican parties are Wall Street parties. And so I'm hoping that independent parties will not, you know, just kind of close up shop after the election, that they'll continue organizing and building over the next 4 years and continue trying to influence local elections, and that hopefully the next, you know, in 4 years it'll be a different situation. My partner, Kevin Veith, ran in 2006. He ran for state senate in the state of Maryland because the person that was running on a Democratic ticket was running as an anti-war candidate, but he was, you know, actually very pro-war. And so Kevin was able to run a unity campaign and was the first person to be endorsed by three parties. He was endorsed by the Greens, the Libertarians, and the Populist Party. To try to take on, you know, these corporate parties. And I think that's a great model, if people are willing to do that.
Well, even if at least we could be enough of a threat to get them to start, you know, acting in our favor for a change and not tricking the public with poor bills. But anyway, if I got a little bit more afraid, maybe they would do something different. In the meantime, we're cooking. We're just on the fryer, you know.
Yeah.
I have a little bit different take. This is Cindy. I think that the entire system from, you know, the rigged voting booth to Madison Avenue and the media, you know, there's so many forces that are aligned with the 1%, or who, you know, the entity I call the robber class, and all of you on this call, I think, are my Facebook friends, and you know how I feel about the system, and it's not just about the 1%, it's all of these systems that support the 1%, and I don't see them changing without a revolution. I don't see that
that working within the system is obviously it's not going to change the system. So I think we would spend better time organizing, like Margaret said earlier, outside the system to create healthy structures, because this system is going to collapse. That's in the future. I mean, anybody who's studied empires and, you know, the system that we have here knows that the U.S. empire will collapse. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. So if we're too busy playing their games and being distracted every 2 to 4 years by federal electoral politics, we're going to be seriously left out when it does collapse. So I think, you know, in my opinion, I think organizing is better than to join forces outside the system to create things that will be healthier for us when the empire does collapse. And this isn't like a doom and gloom. I'm not forecasting doom and gloom. This is where we can really derive our hope, I think, is from outside the system.
Maybe a sideline effort might be in organizing, might be to find philanthropists who would be interested in supporting a cooperative for people to start healthy corporations owned by the
And I have seen the model of that happening in healthcare. This is Cindy again. This is what they did in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. A bunch of healthcare providers got together, used their own time, their own money, and their own energy to build a healthcare clinic for the community. You know, and that's a wonderful model that we can look at too. Not these top-down, heavy bureaucratic models, but models that can work in our own communities, you know, around anything, healthcare, you know, trade, the financial, the environment, growing our own food security, all of this can be organized outside the system instead of, you know, we can do the same thing that we do, you know, is like Margaret is doing to try and force policy change on the national level. But while we're doing that, we should be also organizing very effectively on the local level, and I know Margaret does that also.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that completely. I still think, I've been telling people, don't put your energy into electoral politics right now. That's for later. Right now it's education and movement building and building alternative systems. I do think it would be interesting if political parties outside of the Democrats and Republicans were interested in talking about joining forces in some way to organize and be more effective in you know, pushing on that. But if you go to our website, itsoureconomy.us, you will see lots of resources on things that are happening from the benefit corporations, the B corporations, which are more socially responsible, to participatory budgeting, public banking, cooperatives. This is actually the United Nations Year of the Cooperative. There's a lot that's happening, forming what's called a solidarity economy, and there's a whole solidarity economy network around the world that's really exciting, and it's growing here.
That's wonderful. Okay. I don't want to sound like a Chicken Little when I leave the conversation here, but we just need to do it while we still have water to drink.
Yeah, well, there's also a good article on It's Our Economy that we just posted recently by a Russian who talks about he wrote it actually in 2006, but it's pretty pertinent today. He writes about the fall of the Soviet Empire and compares the conditions there to how the United States is going to do when the empire collapses here. And it's a good article for discussion because in comparison, and we all know there was tremendous suffering after the collapse of the Soviet Empire, they were actually better prepared for that collapse than the United States did because they had a public health system, they had public housing, they were more used to kind of growing their own food, they had more, you know, nuclear families, those kinds of things. So we really need to think about that in our communities. How are we going to organize to start meeting our needs, you know, as things fall, as the economy continues to go.
Okay, great. We're going to move on to Lorenzo in Pennsylvania. Thank you, Richard. If you can remute your phone at *6. And Lorenzo, if you'd like to ask your question, to Margaret. You can unmute your phone at star 6. Hello?
Can you hear me now?
Yes. We can hear you, Lorenzo.
Yeah. My question is referring to building the mass movement that Margaret is talking about. Part of the deal that we need to deal with the reality of what we have in front of us, which is, in my opinion, that we don't have that much time to play with. We are not in a very secure society. It is very easy that we could fall into a fascist type of society, and that's a joke, and that is, would be a very disastrous thing. And my question comes from the point of something that I have seen here in Pennsylvania mentioned sometimes by Wendell Potter, and I also understand that Michael Moore also has somewhat of a similar position, which is that it would be a good thing for us to do to be able to create working ties with people that support the Affordable Care Act. And the reason that I'm saying that is because their enemies are our enemies. And when we are together, we are the majority. Not by far the majority, but we are the majority. And we then start from a much stronger position than being in the minority. I am a union organizer. That's my job. I am a union organizer. And when we organize a place, we divide the people that we are trying to organize. We know that we have the ones are very committed people, the two are supporters of the union, that are probably will vote for the union, the three are those kind of in the middle type, and the four are the people that are against it, but they are not sectarian about it, and the fifth, forget about it. Those are the people that we don't even waste our time talking to them. When we try to win an election, we try to win over the one, the two, and the three. And he's able to get a good chunk of the three, then we are for sure winning. Now, if we could work, here in Pennsylvania, we tried a little, somewhat, and for unknown reasons, it didn't work. It would take too much to explain that. But we tried what it was called the healthcare council. And it was working with people, progressive people, because there is a lot of people that nominally support the Affordable Care Act that are also supporters of single payer. I am one of those. And like me, and I mentioned already Wendell Potter, I mentioned Michael Moore, there is a lot of other people that are on the same boat. And we, by working together in community groups that will work towards, for example, and I'm going to try to finish as soon as possible. It's just that I can see it. I can see how we can organize about, around it. And we can organize in terms of explaining the Affordable Care Act. We can organize explaining the deficiencies in the Affordable Care Act. And we can organize explaining the strength of single payer and then even increase the consciousness of people toward Medicare for All. Let me finish here because I don't want to monopolize the thing, but I really believe that in order to create that mass movement that Margaret is talking about, which I strongly believe is necessary, I strongly agree with her, we need to throw a net wide. And I know that where her background is from, so she understands what I'm talking about. Okay.
Yeah, thank you, Lorenzo. I mean, I agree with you. I think that's why education is so important right now. We need to be getting out and talking to other groups and looking at what the real facts are of what works and what doesn't work and having these conversations. In Maryland, we're kicking off our Healthcare as a Human Right campaign. It's we'll be organizing a grassroots campaign, much like Vermont did. I know that Oregon and other states are doing the same thing, just to get into these communities, start holding truth hearings to talk about what's really happening to people around healthcare and educate about why single payer, is a better solution for our healthcare.
Okay, awesome. Thank you, Lorenzo. We have one final comment or question from Bob in Michigan. Bob, would you like to unmute your phone and ask or give Margaret your comment and talk about that? It's a very pertinent comment. Bob, are you there? Okay, I'll do Bob's comment then. Bob actually is in Medicare for All. Bob, are you there?
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, great.
Hi, Bob.
So you can...
Hi, Margaret.
You can chat with Margaret about what you emailed me.
Oh, okay. Margaret, yeah, hi.
First,
I wanted to compliment you on your fast speaking. As Cindy said, you covered a lot of ground. I think you did an excellent job. My input to that is that you mentioned France has the best healthcare system in the world, and I just wanted to have you join me on clarifying to the people on the call that France does perform very well on healthcare outcomes, but the U.S. will have the best healthcare system in terms of how to pay for healthcare with one plan and one payer, whereas France has hundreds of nonprofit sickness funds. So it's fantastic to know that we can be positioned with HR 676 to be the best of the best. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, France actually has a single-payer system. It's publicly financed, groups pay into it, but it's a single system. And then the majority of the population, like 90 or 95% of the population in France, has supplemental insurance, but it's a mutual, it's a nonprofit, it's very affordable, and it's just for kind of the extras. But the national system pays first, and then the supplemental pays second. But what the point is that Bob was making is that the United States spends more per person each year on healthcare than any other industrialized nation. We have excellent hospitals. We have excellent training facilities. If we actually had a healthcare system that was about health and we put our dollars into that system, we would have an excellent system. We wouldn't be ranked 37th in the world. We could be in the top systems of the world. And that's really, one thing that I end a lot of my presentations with when I do PowerPoint talks is that, why aren't we in this nation where we're always so obsessed, supposedly, with being the best? Why aren't we trying to be the best healthcare system in the world instead of the most privatized and corporate welfare system in the world?
And the key word is efficiency in that. And as Margaret communicated earlier, we have a lot of bureaucracy, and it's actually three bureaucracies. It's not just the health insurance companies, over 1,000. It's also the government bureaucracy. We have way too much government programs, and it's also the related bureaucracy that comes out of the other two, because we have organizations that help you use funds that couldn't possibly cover your costs, and we have Medicaid lawyers that help you drain your finances. It's just an incredible array of multiple bureaucracies, and efficiency will get us there. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you, Bob. We go through such hoops trying to make this thing that doesn't work work, and it's just not workable.
I just want to ask you another question, Margaret, and then if you can give your contact info and websites again. You went through those really, really fast, and you seem to have a lot of them.
Sorry.
But that's okay. I have a question. like Bob's question and what I said, John Boehner said today in Congress was that, you know, we have the best house delivery system in the world. And, you know, we're always saying, we hear people say, oh, we have the best health care system in the world. We have the best education system in the world, you know, blah, 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 on and on and on. Where really we have the best war-making system in the world, the best prison, putting people in prison, the highest percentage and things like that. How many people do you think, you know, that aren't like us, you know, that pay attention to things, how many people do you think we have to reach in this country to say no, that, you know, actually, just because you're used to this system, it's a system you're used to, it doesn't make it good. It can be better. It can change.
Well, fortunately, I mean, I don't have a hard and fast number, but we know from other nonviolent movements that we don't have to reach every single person. You know, you can build a movement, and you reach a tipping point, and you can be effective. Even, you know, what was interesting is that when the Super Committee was meeting last fall and they were getting ready to cut Medicare and Social Security, and we were organizing and protesting in the committee, outside of the committee, on the streets, holding our own hearings. People were walking from Occupy Wall Street to D.C. to protest. It wasn't a huge amount of people, but we feel that it was effective in putting pressure on them and letting them know that we were watching, and that if they had cut Medicare and Social Security, that we would be way, you know, it would have just grown exponentially because we were aware and we were watching what they were doing. So that's really key. That's important. I also think it's important to realize that in terms of many of these kind of positions on the issues, opposing war, you know, wanting a green economy, wanting money out of politics, supporting worker rights, health care for all, public education, all of these things, we already have super majorities of people in the United States that support these positions. So we actually are the majority. And so a lot of it is empowering people to say, okay, stop accepting, you know, what you're told that you can have, and start asking and demanding what it is that we require as a nation. And I think as more people do that and people see that happening, it will empower others to do the same thing. So I encourage everybody to get out there and be vocal and to keep telling the truth, because that's what, you know, I have a George Orwell quote on my email right now, which is that in times of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. That's what we need to be doing.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Margaret. This was a wonderful call. I want to thank everybody who called in and participated. And like I said, it will be on Cindy Sheehan's soapbox this Sunday. And, of course, I'll always send the links out. But, Margaret, how can people get a hold of you and the websites that you referenced tonight?
Sure. My email address is my name, Margaret. It's MARGARET at PNHP.org. That stands for Physicians for a National Health Program, PNHP.org. That's also a good website, PNHP.org, for information. If you're new to single payer, there's a whole section that you can click on that has good information, as well as it's organized by different subjects. If you're knowledgeable about single payer already, but you want to keep up with what's going on, Don McCann has something called the Quote of the Day, and you can sign up to receive that. And every day you get a very brief email telling you about something that's new in the news with healthcare, and he gives a short commentary on it. The nationwide kind of grassroots organizing body is Healthcare Now, and that's not to be confused with Healthcare for America Now, which is a very well-funded group that was pushing for the public option and supporting the Affordable Care Act. But Healthcare Now is healthcare-now.org, and they have chapters in most states. If people want to get involved with that. My websites are It's Our Economy, so ITSOUR economy.us, and that's an economic democracy website that we update regularly, pretty much daily,
with news and information, and there's also reports that we've published on there from educational events that we've put forward. So it's itsoureconomy.us, and then also the October2011.org, which is the website that we used when we were organizing the occupation of Freedom Plaza. And that website, we keep up to date with kind of what's going on in the Occupy movement and work that's being done there. So then you can sign up for email lists at either of those websites.
Dr. Margaret Flowers, thank you so much for being on this national conference call. It was amazing, and thanks for your time, and thank you for your work, and we'll talk to you soon.
Well, thank you, Cindy, and thank you for everybody for your great questions, and let's, you know, keep up the good work. I think that hopefully we'll be successful.
Well, one of these days, and thank you, everybody, for joining the call. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
This is Cindy Sheehan, and that was Dr. Margaret Flowers and many, 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 many people who joined us in that national conference call. I think that that was a really interesting format, and we're hoping to do more shows like that in the future, maybe at least once a month where we can participate. People can have their say and have their voice heard. It's hard when we don't have a live show to do that. So I think that it was really exciting to hear many, many different voices giving their ideas and asking their questions. And I'd like to thank Margaret for joining us again. She took a lot of time out of her busy schedule to be with us. I'd like to thank everybody who participated in the call. I'd like to thank Don DeBar from Community Progressive Radio. I'd like to thank my producer, Mikey. And I'd especially like to thank you for listening and supporting the show. So I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Peace out for now.